Welcome to Census Pod's latest podcast program with Dr. Pamela Line. Dr. Line earned a bachelor's degree in biology from Cornell University and a degree in environmental health sciences from East Tennessee State University. She also has a PhD in pharmacology and toxicology from the University of Buffalo. Dr. Line completed her postdoc training in molecular immunology at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo. She is currently a professor of neurotoxicology and chair of the Department of Molecular Biosciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of California, Davis. In addition, she holds a faculty appointment at the UC Davis Mind Institute, which collaborates closely with Census Cultural. Dr. Line's research has been continuously funded by the U.S. National Institutes of Health over the past 20 years. She's also a prolific writer and has had 225 peer-reviewed publications at least and book chapters. Finally, she received recently an award from the UC Davis of Graduate Studies for excellence in graduate student mentoring. We are absolutely delighted to welcome Dr. Line to this podcast program. Welcome, Dr. Line. Tell us about your background, please, and what led you to pursue the field you are in.
My training was initially in the area of biology as an undergrad, and I got very interested in how chemicals interact with biological systems. This is based on a really cool course that I took with a professor at Cornell University who talked about insects and plants using chemicals as biological weapons. From there, I took a course in poisonous plants and really got involved and interested in toxicology, so I went back to get my PhD in toxicology. It was during the course of my PhD training that I realized that there are a lot of chemicals in our environment that can influence how humans develop disease and how rapidly disease progresses. And from there, I got very interested in looking at how chemicals can influence the development of the nervous system and also neurodegeneration. And one of the driving reasons for this interest of mine and the research that I do is that while we understand the role of genetics in disease processes, and there's a great appreciation for genetic causes of disease, today, it's really difficult to really control the genotype or the genetics of an individual. So if we can identify environmental risk factors, such as environmental chemicals, that influence either the risk for disease or the severity of the disease, they could potentially be much more readily controlled and impact a broader section of the population. And so we could actually really cause significant improvements in human health as a result of really understanding and identifying environmental chemicals that increase risk for disease.
That's really fascinating. What a background. How do you explain, based on your firsthand experiences, the link between environmental factors and neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism spectrum disorders?
That's really a great question. So through many years of research, we now have a very keen appreciation for the fact that environmental chemicals can really modify ongoing signaling in the nervous system. And this means modifying signaling pathways that are important for laying down the connections during development and then sculpting those connections to form a functional nervous system. So we now appreciate or believe is that certain environmental chemicals can interact with signaling pathways that are also impacted by genetic mutations associated with high risk for autism spectrum disorder and other types of neurodevelopmental disorders. So if we have environmental chemicals that interact with the same pathways as the genetic factors, these two could amplify each other's effect to push an individual over the threshold for manifesting disease.
Is there any specific data that shows a direct link between these environmental factors and ASD. I mean, I'm sure that you have come across or led plenty of research in this field. Perhaps you can share a bit more information for our listeners about what the science says more in detail about the connection between environmental pollutants and ASD. What are some measures being taken nationwide to reduce the impact of environmental factors affecting ASD?
Sure, that's really important to understand. So there are two lines of evidence, general lines of evidence, that establish a link between exposures to environmental chemicals and increased risk for neurodevelopmental disorders such as autism. One line of evidence is epidemiologic. So in epidemiologic studies, scientists look for associations between exposure levels to specific environmental chemicals and increased risk for a disease state, for example, autism. So there have been a large number of epidemiologic studies that have shown, for example, a positive association between air pollution and increased risk for autism spectrum disorders. In other words, people who have higher exposure to air pollution, pregnant women and or young children, are more likely to have a diagnosis of autism than people who live in less polluted areas. Another environmental chemical that's been associated with increased risk of autism includes the pesticide chlorpyrifos and other organophosphate pesticides, which are very commonly used in urban settings as well as rural settings. And then also polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, which are pretty ubiquitous contaminants that have persisted in the environment for many, many years, despite their production being banned in the late 1970s. The other major line of evidence we have that links environmental chemicals to increased risk for autism is experimental studies. These are animal or cell culture studies in which the experimenter or research scientist can more directly manipulate the experimental variables and control for confounding factors, which is not possible to do in an epidemiologic study. Or I shouldn't say not possible, but is much more difficult to do in an epidemiologic study. So there are a variety of experimental studies that have been published now, including some out of my own lab, that have shown that in animals that are exposed either during gestation and lactation or as young pups to some of these environmental chemicals through routes of exposure that are very similar to human routes of exposure, do have an increased tendency to exhibit phenotypes that are very similar to what we see in children with autism. Of course, there is no such thing as an animal model of autism. Autism is a uniquely human experience, but we are able to recapitulate various parts of the autism picture, so clinical phenotypes that are very relevant to what we see in children with autism. And so in these studies, again, we have shown a relationship, we and others have shown a relationship between exposure to air pollution at levels that are comparable to what humans would be exposed to and expression of autism-like phenotypes. Also, we've shown that the pesticide chlorpyrifos, as well as PCBs, also increase the expression of autism-relevant phenotypes in animal models.
What are some measures being taken nationwide to reduce the impact of environmental factors affecting ASD?
So that's a great question. There are not too many really sort of general approaches nationwide that have been taken to reduce exposure specifically with the intent of decreasing the risk of autism spectrum disorders. There are some state level responses for specific pesticides. For example, in the state of California, residential use of chlorpyrifos is banned, and there have been some more strict regulations put in place about notifying individuals about pesticide spraying, for example. But again, at sort of a nationwide level, most of the efforts have really been through children's health advocacy groups or autism spectrum disorder parent groups with parents and individuals who have become informed about the types of exposures that may increase risk for autism or are linked to increased risk for autism. And they have been developing sort of guides for individuals to mitigate or reduce their personal exposures to causative factors to try and reduce effects on either children who are already born or children who have yet to be born. So again, Again, unfortunately, not too much of a unified national effort to really reduce exposure specific to autism.
Well, thank you very much for this clarification, and you have already partially answered the next question that I am about to ask. And that is, what can you tell us about treatments, perhaps the latest ones, that reduce the impact of environmental pollutants causing ASD?
Well, I think there are sort of a number of prevailing questions that have been actively researched recently. We're beginning to gain some increased understanding. The first is that these environmental exposures do not affect everybody equally. So there are genetic susceptibility factors that make individuals more or less susceptible to the developmental neurotoxic effects of environmental chemicals. So one of the outstanding data gaps in the area is identification of specific gene by environment interactions. So in other words, what are the specific genetic mutations or genetic backgrounds that interact with specific environmental chemicals to cause changes in brain development that result in a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder? So we're beginning to make some progress in that. There's been some exciting studies that have been published recently identifying, for example, mutations in genes that modify calcium signaling as increasing susceptibility to the developmental neurotoxic effects of polyclonal biphenyls or PCBs. There's also been another recent study published using human stem cells showing that expression of the mutations in CHDX8, which is an autism risk gene, will increase susceptibility to chlorpyrifos, organophosphate pesticide we've been talking about. So that's an area that's been of great interest because it will hopefully help clinicians and parents identify subpopulations that are more or less at risk for specific environmental factors. On the flip side, there's been a lot of progress in understanding the mechanisms by which environmental chemicals can change neurodevelopment to give rise to phenotypes that are relevant to autism spectrum disorders. And so by understanding that, we're beginning to be able to leverage research in neuroscience or in autism that have identified some treatments that can counteract, if you will, the effects of genes, and in this case, environmental chemicals, on some of the signaling pathways and neurodevelopmental processes that we know are altered in autism. So one kind of exciting experimental finding that has yet to be proven clinically is that using vitamin E can actually protect against some of the neurodevelopmental toxicity of PCBs.
Well, that said, and about the very important work that you do on the science front, but in general, how do you raise awareness about environmental factors and their impact on ASD?
So I think there are a number of ways that we can do this. One is in medical education. So actually changing the curriculum that medical students are exposed to make them aware of the impact of environmental chemicals on brain development. It's amazing how little is actually taught to medical students regarding neurotoxicology in general and environmental chemicals in general. So I think that's one area where we could have a really big impact. The other area is just through good old public relations outreach. So the MIND Institute at the University of California, Davis, with which I'm affiliated, is doing a really good job of that, as are other institutes around the country. Parent advocacy groups are another great resource to reach out and have scientists such as myself and my colleagues give webinars and give seminars in more or less layman's terms to really educate parents and other advocacy groups about what we know regarding environmental chemicals and autism spectrum disorders and steps that can be taken to reduce their exposures, which frankly at the moment is probably the most effective approach that we have, is to reduce exposure. Once autism has been set in place, controlling chemical exposures may have an impact on progression and or severity, although we don't know that for a fact. But certainly we do know that if we can reduce exposures, we do decrease the risk for autism risk disorders.
Thank you so much for these very important pieces of information about raising autism awareness, which brings me to our last question. At Census Cultural, our mission is to raise awareness about autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders, and we do so by promoting our podcast program and educational webinar series with scientists and researchers. We're also very keen to understand how we can develop new curriculum to help communities in need better understand autism. In general, we are dedicated to this mission and to raising as well awareness about available treatments and supporting the science on autism above all. Do you have any specific piece of advice for us about how we might be able to improve what we already do in order to better serve the people who and the communities who deal with autism?
That's a really great and somewhat loaded question. So, you know, I think there's two aspects to your question. One is, what could your organization do to further awareness amongst affected populations regarding the impact of environmental chemicals on risk of autism? And I think, you know, a lot of the, if you will, disparities, or that's not the right word, but a lot of the breakdown in communication is what I'm looking for, really is in translating the science into terms that are understandable by the general public. And I admit that as scientists, we're not particularly good at that. We're not trained to do that. We need to get better. But I think organizations such as yours could be really critically important in helping scientists translate their research findings into terms that are meaningful to the intended audience. So that would be one thing that would be extremely helpful, I think. I think the other is that, you know, we live in a world of competing resources, limited resources for research. And so it's always a struggle to get funding to conduct the type of research that's needed to A, identify which environmental chemicals are critically linked to increased risk of autism, and B, understanding how they do that, because it's through the understanding that we'll be able to develop treatments. And so having organizations such as yours work in collaboration with parents and other advocacy groups to really lobby Congress, to lobby in the United States, and to lobby the funding agencies to put resources into this type of research would be another area that would be of incredible help.
Dr. Line, thank you very much for that important advice and for agreeing to do this podcast program with us. We look forward to hosting you soon again.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I hope I was able to address some of your questions in a manner that was understandable, and I do look forward to further conversations, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about our work.
Thank you again.